Dr. Brian Halverson is one of the UK's leading holistic dentists. He is the author of Great Teeth for Life and lectures widely to the public and to health practitioners. Brian is passionate about providing preventative information to guide us through all the stages of our lifetime. To find out more about Brian, go to www.brianhalverson.com. And now here is Dr. Brian Halverson.
I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way.
Hi, Brian here, the Integrated Dentist for UK Health Radio. It is my great pleasure to introduce Richard Stead, who is a chemist and has been working on a very, I think, vital part of a health-linked problem that is facing us in what I will call possibly proportions that will affect the whole world. Richard is a chemist and has been working on this subject for 15 years. Richard, can you just tell me a little bit about yourself and how you first of all got involved in your subject?
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here, Brian. Thanks for the invitation. I am a chemist and I've worked very much for the 40 years I've been in the industry with chemicals. The last 30 or so of those have been with the food industry, supplying chemicals, all sorts of additives and processing aids and so on, quite successfully with my own companies, manufacturing and distributing materials. I became more and more interested in nature's abilities and what they could do and how they were using chemicals. And that was particularly when I was working with seaweeds and with extracts from shells and how nature would use a chemical to hold water, for example, or to make sure water wasn't held. And I became more and more interested in this and looking at how we can adapt and utilize nature's very clever chemistries. I became linked with fresh food processing and about 15 years ago, where, for example, we have chopped lettuce in a bag in a supermarket, and to make sure that we didn't get ill when we ate these, that there was no bacteria or viruses on them, everything had to be washed in a chlorine solution. And knowing how detrimental chlorine can be to our health generally and certainly to our bodies, I thought there must be an alternative for this. And looking around, coming back to the body and thinking, well, how does the body deal with these things? And looking at the immune system, and fascinating to find that the immune system is so much more than just white blood corpuscles. For example, a cough is part of your immune system. It's a physical part to remove dust or fluff or something in your throat, or a sneeze. And the best part, the biggest part of the immune system is in fact the skin. It's huge. But nothing can get past it. Water doesn't pass through it. Bacteria can't pass through it. Viruses, yeasts, and none of them can pass through. I thought it's absolutely fantastic. But then I saw, well, it's got holes in it. Our backsides, our mouth, our eyes. There's got to be something there that's as good and as strong against infectious materials, because the skin isn't there anymore. So we looked in the saliva, looked in the tears, and sure enough, there is something there that is truly amazing that can kill pathogens instantly. And so I adopted that and developed it, look how nature did it, and tried to sell it to the food industry for washing lettuce, tomatoes, whatever it was that would have been chopped up, including cuts of meat and so on and so forth. Sadly, I failed dismally because it proved to be more expensive than the supermarkets and the processors were willing to pay. So I had to give up after 2 years of very hard work, and then adopted it to suit for a medical human and animal treatment. And that's what my company, the Cures Group Limited, is all about. And we've been focusing on that for 8 to 10 years now.
Richard, would you agree that virtually, and it's more of a philosophical question, that in life, everything is about timing. And what may have seemed to be a product way ahead of its time when you first developed it, possibly now has a greater relevance. For example, these alarming reports about antibiotics being virtually ineffective.
I would agree with you. Timing is everything. And the growing problem with antibiotic resistance is a threat to human life. Because that's an area that we are looking at, targeting things where antibiotics don't work, we've had to study the antibiotic market and understand the scale of the problem that exists and that's recognized by governments and by the WHO and so on. So I've looked at the history of this, and governments and WHO and various parts of the world, and people and so on, have been very lax, very poor, which is in the what they have done, which is why we're at this apocalypse that we're approaching now. The resistance to antibiotics began and was first identified and announced to the public by Sir Alexander Fleming, only 2 years after he discovered penicillin, when he said, "Be careful. This is a wonderful thing, but do not abuse it. Bacteria are clever. They can develop ways of surviving." And when it first came on the market 20 years later, penicillin, it was a true miracle. And other antibiotics followed on. Every decade there were things coming along. There hasn't been anything new, any new type of antibiotic or working in a new type of method of attack on bacteria since the 1980s. And there have been reports by governments, by international organizations in the 60s, in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, in the noughties, as we call them, and including in 2012, 13, and 14, when our own government commissioned a report by Lord O'Neill talking about antibiotic resistance. And all of those reports said the same thing, almost word for word. We've got to use antibiotics more carefully. We've got to develop new antibiotics, things to replace antibiotics. We've got to stop using them in animals. We've got to stop doctors prescribing them quite as often as they do. And it's the same thing, time and again, and it adds to the fact that we have such an apocalypse.
Sorry, Richard, I was going to say that really, if we go right the way back to that early penicillin, that, of course, it was a mould. So completely natural. And would you agree that what's happened is that because of the nature of the pharmaceutical industry, we're looking that in effect everything has to be manufactured synthetically, otherwise unfortunately to say, there isn't a commercial value in it. Could this be one of the reasons why there's not so much R&D into looking at products that are derived and possibly are naturally occurring in nature still?
Yes, I think there's some truth in that. Certainly not the whole story. Commercial companies have to make profits. They have to be able to reinvest. And they have to create patents to protect their situation. I think there could be a better way of dealing with patents in all sorts of areas that not only protect companies that invest them, but prevent other companies getting in there to also supply and sell these things. There has to be a better way. But leaving that to one side, that you said it was a mold. It was. It was penicillin is something that is created by bacteria to protect themselves against other bacteria. And all antibiotics have been based upon that. And because they're natural, other bacteria do develop a means of resistance and protecting themselves against that. And that's why almost every antibiotic, if it's used too much, if it's abused, will have resistance developed against it. And that's something that is a problem. The creation synthetically, as you call it, by perhaps just making a slight derivative of a main product, helps us for a short period, but then resistance is developed by these bacteria against that form of antibiotic.
I mean, in, for example, dentistry, it is often very important that we do have a bank of effective antibiotics. For example, if we go back before the era of antibiotics, say an infected wisdom tooth could lead to the throat swelling up and somebody dying, not from the infection, but from being suffocated. So, you know, we do rely heavily on our antibiotics, but unfortunately in dentistry, we are suffering the backlash of possibly not prescribing antibiotics always at the appropriate time, because we've almost got to the point of oversensitive to bacterial resistance, where most of that resistance, especially in the penicillin amoxil strains, have often been because they've been overused, as you quite rightly say, in areas such as animal husbandry.
Yes, animal husbandry is the biggest use in the world. And it's used mainly, in the United States, 80% of antibiotics are used in the animal world. And that's in cows, pigs, chickens, in fish farming, and some of it also in horticulture and agriculture, because plants also get affected by viruses and by bacteria. And destroy a harvest and so on. So all of those, so it's been spread quite widely. In the animal world, it is used what you would call as a preventative. In other words, many cows or chickens or whatever are given a little bit of antibiotic every day in the hope that should a pathogen come along, it can't take hold because the cows already had an antibiotic. What this actually does is to make the animal mature that much quicker and put weight on so that the farmers can get their money a lot quicker than they would have done without these things. And they're called growth promoters, not antibiotics. Now, the United States is in the lead on this, and many other countries. In Europe, it's been stopped. You're not allowed to just use antibiotics unless an animal is has got an infection. And President Obama, a year before he left office, he tried hard to stop this. He recognized the scale of the problem. He tried hard, and nobody would listen to him. Nobody in the agriculture or farming community would do anything about it.
Are we at a stage now, though, when we're talking about the possible disastrous consequences that we can't sort of put the clock back and say, well, if we stop using them, that the bugs that are out there will suddenly, if we use them again without frequent use, would they, in your opinion, become more effective?
No, I think there are too many resistant strains of bacteria out there. I think if we put to one side the antibiotics where we have extreme resistance has been developed against them, if we put them to one side and didn't use them for a couple of generations of people, which is what, 40 or 50 years, then the resistance strains may have died away and gone because they don't need to survive, and these antibiotics would be useful again. However, how are we as people going to survive for 50 years? But let me first of all say that not every antibiotic has resistance developed against it. So there are still lots of them out there. And so if we can identify those and use them more sensibly and not quite so frequently, the amount of prescriptions that are issued in the UK only for antibiotics are over 30 million each year. It's an extraordinary number. And if you imagine, there's lots that are given to by vets for small animals, our pets, and farm animals. There's a huge amount of antibiotics out there. And if you think everything that we give to cows and chickens, they're standing in fields and they're urinating and pooing. And so antibiotics fall into the grass, in the fields, in the mud, washed into rivers. Rivers go into drinking water stations. Rivers go into horticulture, where they're used to water fields and so on. It's spreading. There is a glut of antibiotics, and we're poisoning the land. It's polluted. We've got a lot of work that we have to do to haul ourselves back. So the use of antibiotics, the bad use, is a problem, and Richard, has been a problem. Richard, and we have to, yes. Yeah,
sorry, what I was going to say, just at that one point, are you saying that, in fact, these antibiotics that get into the ecosystem do not get biodegraded?
I'm sure some of them do. I haven't done any studies or read of any studies on them. They might degrade, but if they get washed into the water stream, into rivers, they can make their way through processing. Some of them are very hardy, don't forget.
Gosh. No, I just wanted to bring that fact up because I think this is something a lot of people would find quite distressing, to think that we're recycling these things.
I'm sure we are. I haven't seen anything that measures the extent and so forth. I do know, however, it's very bad in China and India, where they manufacture antibiotics, and the poor control in factories where they're washing out things with water and just letting them flow away into rivers or into sewerage systems is causing a lot of problems, and that's where a lot of the resistance is developing and growing, and then it can, of course, be spread.
Gosh, yes. So now, I understand that you've been looking at possible solutions which could well be also have less side effects. Could you explain where what your research has been going and where you are at this moment in time?
Certainly, and thank you for that opportunity. As I said, I use this technology that is in our mouth and in our tears to fight off infections. In the food industry, was not very successful. We had done a lot of laboratory work against every pathogen you can imagine, and it was very effective against them, as effective as chlorine could be, and in some cases more effective and somewhat quicker. So we identified the way that nature makes this and copied that exactly. You might say synthetically, but we were using the same components that the body uses. There's one called thiocyanate, which we get into our body by eating green vegetables. We use some enzymes that come from milk, which duplicate enzymes that are in our tears and in our saliva. And these combinations of things create, upon demand, an active ingredient, which is called hypothiocyanate. And it's what the body's got. It's what nature designed and developed. And it's to stop little bits of pathogens that might be on the lettuce that we've just picked up from our garden, or on the steak that we've cooked and sat on a plate. And, of course, we have bacteria in the air all the time. Things could drop on that. And when we eat it, put it in our mouth, so long as we can get our saliva on it, the saliva jumps into action, and if there's an E. coli there, or a salmonella, it is zapped instantly. It's killed off straight away. And So I've copied that. It has an interesting life cycle that the molecule doesn't last very long. And so it was impossible for us to manufacture it in bulk in a factory and put it in bottles. So it has to be made at the point of use. And it's very good. We've tried it in all sorts of areas. And I think that we could have a very, very big effect upon not just the problems with antibiotics and overcoming their problems. We could also be very effective in the microbiome. And we have, as you know, around our body many microbiomes. There's one in the mouth, which is different than the one on the skin, which is different on the one in our on our genitalia, and very different from that we have in the gut, in our colon, the large colon. And the gut there, and so many problems that occur in the gut that lead to problems in the brain, and the other way around. Problems in the brain can lead to disruption of the microbiome in the colon. And nowadays, every week there are new papers talking about there's a link between Alzheimer's and dysbiosis in the gut. There's a link between autism and dysbiosis in the gut. All sorts of mental conditions, schizophrenia and various others. It's quite extraordinary. And I'm sure that with the safety of our product, that we could do wonderful things for the gut microbiome in removing and killing off the bad bacteria that are down there. That's only a first step, of course. You've then got to build up the good bacteria that are there to make sure that they work very well.
That's right. I mean, it's a very much a very complex ecosystem. And I think the problems with often, from a dental point of view especially, when we're using certain chemicals which are effective at clearing away superficial mouth infections, they also disrupt the ecosystem in the mouth, as will often a lot of the antibiotics, so that we end up having a remainder of more pathogenic bacteria than beneficial ones. And I think what you're talking about with your product does seem to be a way of solving this problem, because as you were saying, that it appears to be targeting the pathogenic bacteria, therefore allowing the beneficial ones, which tend to be destroyed even by, for example, our diet. You know, for example, if we have too much sugar, we tend to benefit the pathogenic bacteria, the pathogenic yeasts and what have you. So obviously, diet is a very important factor, but the difficulty with our lifestyles today is that we need more than just a change of diet, because often it's impossible to have that perfect diet that will slowly bring about the right types of proportion of probiotics, prebiotics, everything else to help the gut. So I think I'm very excited about what you're talking about.
Well, thank you, and I also am excited about it. There are many things that have caused our problems. For example, if we look at the quality of food that comes out of the ground, the nutrient value in carrots today is so poor compared with that of the 20s and the turn of the century. There have been several reports talking about this 30, 40 years apart, and so I mentioned earlier that one of the components that's necessary in the saliva to make this molecule that we produce is thiocyanate, and that has to come from green vegetables. Well, the quality of the green vegetable that we are eating now is so poor that maybe we have a lack of thiocyanate in our body. So making this molecule in our body could well be a problem. We're not making enough of it. And things like that are making us vulnerable. And so if we look first of all at the quality of our farming, instead of trying to churn out more from each field, if we looked and try to make the farming community generate a better quality of wheat or of cabbage, so that we could learn to eat less, but we would then have all the nutrients that we needed. And that's all of them, like zincs and iron, magnesium, and so on and so forth. That's only one side of it. And we think of all the things that we put in, and we talk of antibiotics. Antibiotics do, as you said earlier, destroy a lot of the microbiome, the good bacteria that are down there. And recovering from that can take a long time. But there is more work being done. The quality of probiotics and what they should be, but the ones that we want, we are very interested in the microbiome, to the point that we have just launched a new stool test, whereby we take a sample of the stool, and we can identify every bacteria that is in there. This is part of the follow-up to the DNA work that, as we know, was invented within the UK. And using DNA and then specialist parts of that, we can identify every bacteria. So we can see the bad ones that are there. And also, after an antibiotic treatment, we could see the ones that are now missing and showing why there is problems in the gut. And we could look at that for an autistic child and follow up, what can we do? This treatment, that treatment, this therapy, those foods, and we can see how well they work afterwards. And this would be a great step forward in our understanding and checking and validating treatment protocols that are available. And it's going to be an exciting time.
I totally agree. And when you're looking especially at the autistic spectrum, and I was looking at even to the point of view of preconceptual preparation during pregnancy, if this isn't safeguarded, and say by looking at our key components, which is, I think, the healthy balance of our microbiome, then the child in the womb is going to suffer. Therefore, the consequences are that those growing cells are going to be deficient or defective, leading to all sorts of problems for generations to come, which could be avoided. And I believe that, say, for example, products such as you have, if I may say or ask you, are they completely without any side effects? Because this is what most people always inquire about any sort of product that's actually possibly introduced, which isn't completely, inverted commas, coming from nature.
Well, we haven't, I can't say that at the moment, because we have not carried out any clinical trials. What we have done, though, we have carried out what we would call a clinical study in humans, which was, we treated just over 100 humans. And we got the results back from the first 54. Now, this trial was on a condition that we call upper respiratory infection. We chose that one because it is the biggest single condition for which antibiotics are prescribed. It's also the biggest single condition for which time is lost from work. In America, in a year, there is over 100 million days are lost from work. Now, when they're lost, when somebody doesn't turn up from work, the employer loses out because they don't have the productivity level. The employee doesn't get paid. And, of course, the health services, it costs them money to treat that. And the other sad thing about that is that many GPs will issue antibiotics for somebody who's got an upper respiratory infection, and 80% of those are viral. So the antibiotics won't work. That adds to the proliferation of antibiotic resistance. But it's also costing health services a fortune. Doctors are under a lot of pressure. If you've got a child that goes to see a GP, a three-year-old child with earache, how is the mother going to accept from the doctor when she said, oh, leave it two more days, heal itself. But coming back to the upper respiratory tract, the amount of time lost, the cost to the world is huge. And so we carried out our test on upper respiratory tract. And of the 54 that reports that I've had in now, 80% of those, after one treatment, 24 hours later, they said, "We're going to work."
Gosh.
And 96, after 48 hours, said that they would go back to work. They hadn't lost any more than one day. And normally, the average is 3 to 4 days of time off work and lost income. So that would save a fortune for all sorts of people with our product. And so that's what we've looked at. Now, those 54 also commented that they had no side effects, nothing. And we were very clear that they must be pressed about side effects, because we want to be sure. If there is something, then we sort of would have to stop a trial or our study. But all of them said, no, there were no side effects whatsoever.
Well, Richard, this is very, very impressive. So where would you like to see things go with your product?
Well, I'm looking for more investors. I have spent a lot of time, a lot of my own money, and brought it to quite a forward stage. And I think that we could have the product on the market in about 3 years' time. We've got all the plans of the work we need to do, how much it's going to cost, all laid out. We're looking and hoping that the government might give us a grant. But sadly, there is no grant that's available or projected to be available to find something to replace an antibiotic. It's just not there. The current grant that we're looking for is a total fund of 15 million, but that's looking at three or four different aspects of the health industry, but nothing that is specifically to help anybody find an alternative to an antibiotic. So that's one thing I'm looking for, and I'd love to welcome some investors who see that the health in our health industry needs this help to find and replace antibiotics. That's what I'd like to do. And we would then need a sum of money that I've got written down somewhere. It's not billions, which the pharmaceutical industry tends to say is needed. We could get to and complete a trial in with just a few millions, just less than 10 million, which is not a large amount of money for an antibiotic development.
Absolutely.
So that's where I'd like to see it go. So if any of your listeners are out there, or even yourself, Brian, come along and invest with us.
I'm not on the, what should we say, on the sort of what I'll call the resources to do that, but I do know a lot of people who may well be interested, especially when you're looking at this further link to so many what I will call inflammatory diseases, such as you say, autism, Alzheimer's. And one of my previous speakers actually was also talking about chronic inflammation leading to virtually all our diseases, you know, heart disease, diabetes. So we're looking at something that could, if it could only really push things a bit forward, as you say, would be an investment, not just from the point of view of making a healthier community, but also, and much, much more importantly, taking this huge burden of cost for what I would regard as avoidable disease.
Yes, and inflammation is well known for causing lots of problems. And this molecule that I'm talking about that we make, the body makes this at various places around the body. It also utilizes this and creates it at places where it has inflammation. Inflammation is often caused by the availability of chloride ions and also of hydrogen peroxide. And this molecule utilizes both of those things and breaks them down and stops them being inflammatory. So I've just touched upon killing infections. What it's been published in for over 30,000 academic papers on this molecule. What it can do is amazing. But then the body's amazing, and the body and nature invented this. I've merely adopted it and delivered it. So my molecule has got lots of things that it can answer. I've worked upon the principle, nature has the answer, chemistry is the key. And these are three areas of chemistry: fighting infection, the gut microbiome, and inflammation. They are chemical in nature. And so nature's chemistry can deal with them.
I would totally agree. And as you rightly say, if you look at the full cycle of, for example, neurodegenerative diseases, that we know that the brain has a very key element to, for example, causing inflammation in the body, but it's a chicken and egg all the time. You know, so we cannot divorce one without the other. And so if we take psychological stresses on the body, you know, if we are in a healthier, less inflamed condition, we're more able to cope with those psychological stresses. So it's just, you cannot divorce. This is why I'm so fascinated by the holistic approach. And a product like Your Good Selves are developing, which in fact can add a little bit more to one element. Now, I say little bit more because, you know, I don't want to sort of say that it's, and I'm sure you would agree, it's not the total cure or the answer, but could be very significant.
Indeed it could. We think of all these mental diseases, and there are many papers that are coming out saying that perhaps an infection 20 years ago caused something to happen. And our bodies haven't been strong enough, maybe just enough, not through bad diet, and which could be bad vegetables, as well as us choosing to eat bad types of food, types of food that are not beneficial for our body. Maybe these are the reasons that for the last 30 years, people picked up infections, and why we have these conditions that developed over time, and why that Alzheimer's is suddenly so prevalent in our society, and dementia, and perhaps because of autism, it's coming about so much. The other side of antibiotics, which I want to stress to people, go out and do something yourself about it. Talk to your doctors, talk to your GPs. If we don't overcome the antibiotic problem, maybe there will be no more hip replacements. Because if we haven't got antibiotics in which we trust, how dare a doctor open up somebody and leave them vulnerable to catching an infection when there's no antibiotic to treat them afterwards? Similarly with cancer treatments. And what that does, as we know, the very aggressive cancer treatments that are effective at destroying the cancer cells but leave our immune system naked, just nothing. And the body is so vulnerable then, maybe we'll have to stop cancer treatments. It's ironic that cancer treatments get so much money, and deservedly so, but as good as they might be, if we haven't spent the money on antibiotics, we can't use any of those fancy cancer treatments because patients are just too vulnerable. So it's a sad situation that we face if we don't force our governments to do things.
I think you're absolutely right, and I would agree wholeheartedly that there is an assumption, for example, no matter major or minor surgery, that the body is just going to heal itself. You know, so that you have surgeons of all sorts who perform the most perfect operations, and when they go wrong, they think, well, it's something they've done wrong. Well, they've not actually really analysed the fact that possibly the patient's immune system was not going to heal. You know, it's almost like going back to fundamentals.
Yes, it is. It is. Coming back to a bit of history with antibiotics, of course, the first one was identified and developed and invented by Sir Alexander Fleming in 1923. The 100 years before that, the biggest cause of early deaths were infections, and infections of all sorts. But during the 20th century, that changed. When antibiotic after antibiotic was invented, and so come the end of the century, it had changed so that instead of being 30%+ of early deaths, it was less than 20, around 15%. And heart disease and stroke and cancers had taken over, and they were accounting for about 40% of early deaths. But that is changing now with the growth of antibiotic resistance. One old infection that's come back is gonorrhea. We'd got it under control. We'd virtually wiped it out, but it crept back. And now there are more than 50 countries in the world where it is so rife, and it's antibiotic-resistant strains. They've got nothing to treat gonorrhea with. And every year there are about almost 80 million new cases of gonorrhea. And these things will spread around the world. Tuberculosis, many countries have got absolute total resistance to the treatments that they've got. We have got to do something better, because it will be less than 100 years since the miracle of antibiotics came along, and a British inventor came up with it. It would be wonderful if we could find another British invention at 100 years to take over from antibiotics, another miracle that we could have. Otherwise, the miracle of antibiotics will just fade away.
Obviously, it has quite shocked me, and I'm sure many of our listeners, that we're looking at diseases that we thought had passed that are becoming almost epidemic, from what you're saying and the figures globally are, which is very distressing. So this is really part of what, if you've got robust organisations like the World Health Organization giving out really, what should we say, very poor prognosis over what is going to be possibly the major leading cause of death, say in 20 years' time, such as infections, which we cannot control, it's almost staggering that people are not looking at alternative solutions such as what you're proposing.
Yes, it is very sad. I find it very sad, and it's a reason why I've been working so hard and pushing it so hard with my company, the Cures Group. Cures is spelled with a Q, by the way, if anybody's looking for us on the internet.
Okay, could you spell that out?
Yes, certainly. It's Q-U-R-E-S.
Okay.
CuresGroup.com, and you can find out lots of information about us and myself on there. Antibiotic resistance is growing. There are something like 25,000 people in Europe die every year from an infection for which there is no longer an effective antibiotic treatment. Of those, amazingly, 12,000 are in the UK. Half of them are in the UK.
Gosh.
I'd like to know why that is. Is that because of our bad diet, the bad way of living? Is it because our bad way of handling antibiotics? Whatever it is, it's got to be halted. It really has. But it's growing. And there will soon be 50,000 a year and 100,000 a year. And can you imagine in a generation or two, it will be the fact that you and I, everybody, will know somebody who's died from an antibiotic-resistant infection. And that'll be your neighbor, your friend, or even a member of your family. We've got to do something, otherwise it just will continue. And to think that one of our family members has died because we didn't do enough, that's not a responsibility I would like to carry.
No, and sometimes I think that I was shocked by the number of deaths caused by sepsis, where there's been some local inflammation, which again is due to a faulty immune system. And again, I could see fantastic uses for your product in cases of where, you know, the unexpected happened. I mean, just in a dental field, I think there was a case of somebody who just had a small cut on their lip, and they ended up being crippled with an infection, which left them, I think, paraplegic. Because they just could not control it. But it was obviously just the little cut on the lip was just the trigger that was enough to tip the balance. And of course, this is what worries me, that we're all so close to that level of how much more would it take in terms of either a lowered immune system or more powerful, what I call pathogenic microbes could just make it into literally an epidemic.
Yes, sepsis, you're right. Sepsis is now the biggest killer, biggest cause of early death in the UK. 40,000 people a year. That leaves lung cancer at 30,000, quite well behind. And then the third cause, of course, is, bowel cancer. So sepsis is a serious problem. Whether or not my product could do anything, I've no idea, because we've not been able to get near to people that suffer like that, and we haven't done enough research. But it wouldn't take long to do that research. If it's infections, then the chances of this molecule designed by nature of being successful is very high chance, I do believe. Also, I ought to tell you that this molecule doesn't just fight bacteria, it fights viruses. Remember, nature designed it to defend us. So viruses just as easily are attacked and destroyed. And also many yeasts are destroyed by this molecule. Nature designed it to do this job. We can use it to do the same job. Whether resistance would be developed, I don't know. I would think not, because it's been a defense mechanism in humans since humans began. And so, had any pathogenic microbe been able to develop resistance to my molecule, we as a species wouldn't have survived, I'm sure. Nor any mammals, dogs, cats, elephants, none of them would have been able to survive. They all have this as part of their innate immune system.
Richard, this has been absolutely fascinating. Possibly a little bit depressing for many of our listeners, but I think we do need a wake-up call. And I feel it's been an absolute privilege speaking to you. Just again, could you give any details where possibly somebody could, or people who may be interested in supporting you and your development of your product, where they could actually contact you? If there's more than one source, please feel free to give it.
Okay, they can go online and read about us at www.curesgroup, that's Q-U-R-E-S group.com. My telephone number, my office, I'm based up in Cheshire, close to Manchester, where Sir Alexander Fleming developed the penicillin. Telephone number there is 01565-724233. I'd be delighted to talk to anybody that was interested in joining us if they've got ideas along the same lines as ours, as well as investors who'd like to come along to help us bring this to the market more quickly. I'd be delighted if they would make contact with me.
Richard, thank you again, and if I can do anything to help, I'd certainly, you do have my backing.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed the discussion and the chance to raise what I think is a very serious problem. Thanks, Brian. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Richard.
I can see clearly.